Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, episode 2485, and you will notice, as my guest in this episode, a familiar face. Not since Gene Epstein week have we had two back-to-back episodes with Gene Epstein, but here we are doing it. Gene is director of the Soho Forum. He's done so many things over the course of his life. Somebody really ought to write a whole book, but he ought to write a memoir, Living as Gene Epstein. I don't know, but it'd be interesting to me. But Gene, welcome back.
Well, it's really interesting. My son is a documentarian, and he did interviews of his grandparents, and he's doing video interviews, you recall your life. He's done 4 hours with me of interviews of recalling my life, and I'm now only up to about age 14, so there's a lot to come. It's going to be, I guess, eventually a 40-hour PBS series, Tom, that no doubt you'll be able to see as well. So you've got something to look forward to in that regard.
I can't tell you how profoundly I'm looking forward to that. So yeah, let's just...
Okay, you announced the topic. Sometimes I take over a little bit too much, Tom. Go ahead.
I'll announce what the topic is. So as those of you who are on my mailing list and to some extent listeners of the show and follow me on social media know, I've repeatedly mentioned that I was going to be doing a debate at the Soho Forum, which is Gene's organization, April 23rd, 2024. And the resolution, actually, Gene, I don't suppose you, do you happen to have it right off the...
The COVID, that's interesting.
So I've got the exact resolution. The resolution that was to be debated was government-imposed restrictions during the COVID pandemic were prudent and essential.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I was taking the negative on this resolution. And taking the affirmative was going to be Brent Orrell of the American Enterprise Institute. And what wound up happening was 2 days before the debate was to occur, Brent's granddaughter, very, very young, who had had health problems since birth, passed away.
Yeah.
And so Brent could not make it. So Gene and the Soho Forum scrambled to devise an alternative because they knew that quite a few people had intended to travel great distances and had made plans to attend this. So what was decided was, since Brent was very happy to submit his prepared remarks, his opening statement to Gene, along with his slides, Gene would present Brent's side of the argument. Then I would present my side as before, although I would integrate my rebuttal into my statement. And then we would have some interaction with the audience, followed by a summation by me. So not a debate proper, because there's no opposing debater to respond to me. But nevertheless, it took the form of more or less an evening with, like an evening with Tom Woods. So I'll link to the debate in the description of the video and also at tomwoods.com/2485.
It's on podcast and video. And actually, Tom, you describe your slides so well that people could do podcast on it if they so choose while they're driving or whatever else.
That's right. That's right. But it's all the better if you can see the slides actually with your own eyes. So that's how we did it. And I was fairly happy with my presentation.
It was sensational, Tom.
Thank you, Gene.
I'm going to criticize you now, but you still were sensational.
I appreciate that. So we're going to review it right now, the two of us, because we've had a habit of this. You know, in the old days, Lou Rockwell and I would review the presidential debates. But Gene and I review the Soho Forum debates. And, you know, what might someone have said? Or, you know, what was maybe not the best thing to say? And so Gene has no doubt some criticism. But if you don't mind, Gene, I would like to kick it off with something that actually warmed my heart a bit. And that was that during the Q&A portion, somebody asked about Fed policy and said, why did it take so long to see the price increases, you know, the price inflation, when we know the Fed was frantically injecting money into the economy because of COVID? Why did it take so long for the actual, for the results of that to show up in the economy? And so I gave an answer, which I will elaborate on in a minute. I'll tell you my answer. And at the time, Gene said that that was a, quote, reasonably good answer. And, you know, being a good-natured guy, I responded by saying, well, from Gene Epstein, that is high praise, reasonably good answer. So then later in the week, my wife and I had lunch with Gene and his wife, and Gene brings to the lunch two charts that corroborate my argument. And with regret, he told me, yeah, I was insufficiently enthusiastic about your response because it was right on. And I thought, you know, that just gets me right in here. Old Gene Epstein, willing to correct himself.
I said that with a regret. Okay.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say regret like, you know, you're never going to forgive yourself, but in that kind of spirit.
No. Well, again, you know, as I say, we have had some interesting discussions about particular people you've had on the show. And I've occasionally told you to give them a harder time than you do. And we can set aside what you said and what I said. But I told you that I'm privileged to be on your show as often as I have been. And you should give me the hardest time you possibly can. If I'm wrong about something, I mean, fact is that in thinking about it, oddly enough, what you said set off in my mind what Milton Friedman, the monarch of monetarism, had said, which is that there usually is a lag between a jump in the money supply and a jump in prices. Actually, that's pretty much what I was thinking about when I said that's plausible. I was quite eager, of course, to be corrected on that, as I would be, will be the audience that listens to my interviews with you to know that if I get anything wrong, I want it corrected. I thank people for correcting me, and we weren't that far apart. Now, indeed, afterwards, what struck in my mind is that I had been looking at the officially measured savings rate.
Well, let's pause for a minute. Let me explain to people what's going on. Because first of all, we're about to get to all the fun stuff that you guys like, but we have to start with the nerdy economic issue.
So you mean you don't want me to elaborate right now on what?
No, I want you to let me explain first what I said they can understand what you're talking about. So what I said was the issue of price inflation and the issue of monetary policy is not just a matter of supply. Like there's more money, therefore prices go up. It's also a matter of demand. There's also so-called money demand. Mm. And I said to the audience, now I know that colloquially you hear money demand and you think, well, how useful a concept is that? Mm. Everyone has infinite money demand. So I gave people the example. Suppose you win $10 million in the lottery. What are you going to do with it? Well, maybe some of you, the first thing you do is go out and buy a fancy car. But that goes to show you don't have an infinite demand for money because look, the first thing you did was to go throw some of it at a car dealership. Mm-hmm. So the point is that when we talk about demand for money, we're talking about the demand to hold on to money. And I explained that during COVID, we're obviously going through a time of tremendous uncertainty because we've got unprecedented government policies being implemented. We don't know how long they're going to be implemented. We don't actually know what the health effects of all this are going to be. And so this does not, to many people, seem like a good time to go out and splurge on things. It seems like a time to instead keep your powder dry and observe events and hold on to your money. So there was a higher demand to hold money, and that offsets an increase in prices. And then Gene, at our lunch, brought charts showing the U.S. savings rate, in other words, showing that people were holding on to money. The movements in it corresponded exactly to this time frame, and so that lent some plausibility to my version of events. So that was what I wanted to say.
Great plausibility. Yeah. Actually, of course, Tom, you do inspire me to try to say that you're touching upon more wisdom than even you know. The whole Misesian concept of the demand for money is a demand to hold money. And the distinction is made by Mises that if you put your money in easily in 30-year bonds or in equities, in stocks, in a company, you're parking it somewhere. And that's not money anymore. That's an asset. That's a financial asset, and it varies in price. So why do you hold on? Why do you have any money balances at all? And in fact, at one point, Rothbard dazzled us by saying that if you actually knew exactly what you're going to spend every minute of every day going forward for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, then some money manager would say, don't hold any money at all. Just the moment you need the money, liquidate the asset that you're holding. Let's make it stable assets, and you really won't be holding any money at all. So in fact, Rothbard said, essentially, we hold money. We hold, you know, we hold money in terms of credit card assets. We hold near money to some degree, near money in terms of money market funds, mainly because of uncertainty. So I think it's important to elaborate on that point because Mises made a great deal out of it about the whole nature of money, that we would simply, and Rothbard especially said as well, we would just be parking all our money in liquid assets and we wouldn't really be owning any money. So now, what I came upon was not, of course, an Austrian concept of a measure. You said it was the savings rate. They do calculate a savings rate as a percentage of after-tax income. That's the Bureau of Economic Analysis does calculate that. And by the way, it does include the savings that people essentially put into their house as they pay their mortgage. I always get questions of that sort. So you're actually talking about what they define as the personal savings rate. So it does include that, but then it includes, it mostly it's liquidity, mostly it's what you're putting in the bank. And what I found and what I recalled looking at after we spoke is that simply the amount, not just the share of disposable personal income, but I showed you the chart showing the amount of saving that people were simply stashing away in money market funds or in bank accounts went through the roof. Through the first quarter of 2021, it spiked, and then it collapsed by the second quarter of 2021. And the official numbers show that it was not until the second quarter of 2021 that the price spike happened. So, okay, I mean, maybe I've given you more answer than they bargained for, but what I'm saying is that, ironically, the very Austrian concept that you've mentioned, which is that to some degree you can use the amount of savings as the money that you're holding, coincided with the official numbers, that the spike in price inflation happened only one quarter later once that money was depleted and consumer spending started to soar. So anyway, again, more answer than you bargained for, but I, matter of fact, I had that in my notes to congratulate you on that point, that it was a good intuition and I had missed it. I mean, my main point, of course, was only that the enormous spike in money preceded the enormous spike in prices. But when that person asked about the lag effects, it was rather ironic and interesting that Tom gave exactly the right answer. I said it was a reasonably good answer. It was exactly the right answer, borne out by the official numbers. Of course, I should hasten to say that you were using an Austrian concept about the demand to hold money. And obviously, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the Federal Reserve are not Austrians. They keep data according to their own concept of things. But every once in a while, not infrequently, the data that they do keep does affirm and coincide with the concepts that we use. So congratulations on that, Tom.
All right. Thank you, Gene. Now that we've gotten my moment of triumph out of the way.
I want to start with the other inspired moment, which I think gets into a broader discussion. Maybe you'll indulge me in that, but maybe you want to postpone it a little later. But I just simply want to talk about your inspired moment when you got up to speak. I had just the few days before, I had heard Dave Smith exulting about all the debates he's been going on and how much he emphasized that his only frustration is that he's got to combine his efforts with a partner, that he likes to do one-on-one debates.
Yeah.
And indeed, that has been my hobby horse, one versus one. All of our debates are one versus one. And I have particular strong reasons for that. And so I said that evening when I introduced some of the mission of the Soul Forum, the party afterwards, that we only do one versus one debate. So that inspired Tom.
Can I say what I said?
Yes.
Okay. So I got up and said, well, it's very interesting. First of all, I said something very complimentary about Gene Epstein
in
the Soul Forum.
Yeah, yeah.
I said that in this day and age in which there's so much division, which people find it difficult to engage in debates because they demonize each other instead of saying we have an honest difference of opinion, this Soho Forum, where very important issues are debated in a way that generates more light than heat, is a light in the darkness, and we ought to appreciate what Gene is doing. So I said that first. But then I said, you know, the other thing, though, is that Gene said he emphasized the importance of one-on-one debates and the kind they have at the Soho Forum. And I said, you know, isn't that funny? When I first met Gene Epstein back around 2010, it was in the context of the two of us being in a two-on-two debate, and Gene was on my team. And I can't help but wonder if his preference for one-on-one debates comes from having been a member of my two-person team and then him deciding, from now on, forget it. One-on-one is the way to go.
I'm stuck with this guy, Tom Woods. I had such a bad, bitter memory of that experience. No. Of course, I smiled. I thought it was a cute point to begin with, a little teasing of the host and trying an indication that maybe there was some bad blood between us. But in fact, that is a funny story. I looked it up. You're right. It was 2010. I thought it was 10 years ago. It's going on 14 years ago that we first met. And you in your glory days, you had written this fabulous bestseller called Meltdown, that book you turned out in 5 weeks.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And a very good and very well-written and very meaty discussion. I think it's not that maybe not the definitive version today, but it's certainly worth rereading even today, and quite an achievement. And we were teamed up to debate John Fund, who was with the Wall Street Journal, and Warren Coates about the Federal Reserve. And again, it was okay. You and I were actually a pretty good team. And the joke was that you expected that since I was economics columnist at Barron's, I would be libertarian light, and you would have to be the firebrand. And then you were remarked.
Yeah, because Barron's is a very, you know, is a respected publication. It's not considered like bomb throwers or anything like that. I thought old Gene is probably, you know, nice enough guy, but I'm going to have to be the bulldog here.
You thought I was a respectable person, and you
I made that mistake. I thought you were a respectable person. Turns out not.
Well, in fact, no. I was extremely lucky to get the job. I started as commodities editor. They didn't have an economics columnist at the time. When I started in February of 1992, they needed somebody to write about commodities. And happily and luckily, I'd worked in that field and I'd written a book about commodities years before. I was very familiar with it. And through a romantic connection of somebody I got interviewed, and the editor-in-chief, Alan Abelson, didn't like to waste time interviewing other people. He just hired me on the spot. He told me to write an example of a column. I did, and he hired me. And then he made me the economics editor because there was the idea that Brown should cover the economy. And interestingly, when I started covering the economy in early 1990s, that was when the markets began to get very interested in economic data. But I'm elaborating a little bit too much, but Robert Blyberg had been publisher of Barron's, and it did have a sort of a libertarian tradition, a streak. Alan Abelson, the editor-in-chief, was an FDR liberal, but there was a place for a libertarian firebrand. You know, they figured that I could sound off. I was an asset the company. I could never, you know, I marvel to this day, and I haven't read enough about it. Henry Hazlitt, the extremely well, and only a high school diploma, but he really knew his Austrian economics, and he wrote for the New York Times for years. I mean, if you recall, impossible in the 1990s. Anyway, so I was a firebrand, and I made no secret of the fact that I was a libertarian at Barron's, and they regarded that as an asset until many years later when a new editor-in-chief came in, and in February of 2018, 26 years later, I was finally pushed out at a time when I was ready to go anyway. But so I was a firebrand, and I thought that I knew that I could always play a joke on people like Tom, the joke being that I knew that they expected me to be respectable, and they were rather surprised that I was so ferocious in making my arguments. However, while you and I were a good duo on the nature of the Federal Reserve, we just had 5 minutes to speak. We hadn't coordinated. We hadn't gotten a chance. It was a blind date. We hadn't gotten a chance to speak in advance about how we would divide up the argument at all. Neither had the other side. And so that's what inevitably happens. Two against two. Look, if you and I, as I mentioned to you the other day, if you and I became a debating team, I would insist, Tom, that we would have 2-3 hours of consultation on the topic. We would ruminate about it. We would divide up the work. We would coordinate. And we might be a synergistic team. But that never happens. And so really, the reason why I feel so strongly about one-on-one is precisely because there are a lot of debates out there, and the vast majority of them are two against two. And by the way, you know, part of the reason why they do that, is because they want to attract a bigger audience. They figured that more, if they have four people up there rather than two people up there, then there'll be more friends listening to the debate. That's literally the case. That's what Dave Smith said about the debate that he had participated in. And he was frustrated that he couldn't get his points across. And then on top of that, the two against two becomes very fragmented and very soundbitey because there's not enough time to get into the issue. So I twisted your arm, Tom. And yeah. I don't want to make it public, but over lunch, when I asked Tom, you did so well, I would like you to return. And I only do debates of one versus one. So I asked Tom, how much would I have to pay you this time? And Tom named a figure.
I did. I told him $100,000. I'll say it. Yeah. Because that was not my way of actually making Gene pay me that. That was my way of saying, I don't want to do it.
Yeah. I mean,
all right, look. We're a little off the rails here because I think we're trying the patience of people who want to see, you know, want to hear me go after the bad COVID people. But hang on. But see, some of these episodes are for the longtime listeners who know that we're building up to something, that there's a payoff coming. All right.
Look, I'm trying to establish a point, which is that the fact that Tom had to prepare as hard as he did for a one-on-one debate is part of the reason why he was so sensational. I think that Tom, for you libertarians who listen to Tom's show, you probably have noticed he's done interviews on several libertarian podcasts about his book. But I think that you're really missing out unless you hear the presentation that he gave at my Soul Forum.
Thank you.
That's my main point about the one versus one. If you were teamed up with somebody, Tom, it would have been greatly watered down.
Yeah, I agree. And you're right. I did put in more effort because I knew it would just be me and I couldn't rely on anybody else as a crutch.
Yes.
But partly why I would be more willing to do more debates because I'm kind of a jack of all trades. You know, yes. I'm not the world's expert on any one thing. Yeah. So there's always somebody who could probably, quote, beat me in a debate on anything. So I'd rather be in a situation where there's somebody else who's fairly knowledgeable and the two of us can back each other up when we have weak points and stuff like that. But that's neither here nor there.
Have we just gone on the air where Tom Woods has said, I mean, you people out there, do you know how much Tom had to spend cajoling and pleading with Tom to do this debate? Even done all the blood. And now he's saying, I'm very excited. Now he's saying he's not closing the door. Look, let me make another one. There are a lot of very learned people who are not good debaters. You are a good debater, and therefore, you don't necessarily have to be a deeply informed expert. For example, I have said that I've listened to a number of people do debates on the Israeli-Palestine issue, and probably Dave Smith is better than any of them. I think he edges them out, and Dave Smith obviously is a comic. He doesn't specialize, but he reads up, and he's got the talent, just like you have the talent, Tom. So anyway, that's interesting to hear. I'm going to bear that in mind for the future.
Hey, everybody, quick word from Woods here. It's my goal to have the best supporters program out there, better than anything on Patreon or anywhere else. Support the Tom Woods Show, and not only do you get entry into my no censorship Tom Woods Show elite group, but you also get the 16-page Tom Woods elite letter mailed to your home every month. Who else is doing that? This is all new material, completely different from the emails I send, and it is red hot. My supporters also get invites to my murder mystery dinner parties that I've been holding around the country. I'll be adding more cities soon to woodsmystery.com. I hold these in penthouse suites at luxury hotels with a beautiful catered dinner. It's a ton of fun. I also invite my supporters to my annual Christmas party. And the higher up you go as a supporter, the more things you get. Some supporters even get a small gift in the mail from me every month in addition to the newsletter. So go check it out, supportinglisteners.com. You will not believe all the goodies at supportinglisteners.com. And my profound thanks to all of you.
I just want to also mention one thing before we proceed, which is that I just want to call your opponent that evening your opponent because I feel a bit bad criticizing what your opponent said even though I think would be relevant to discuss, because your opponent wasn't there to fully answer what you said. However, I did read out loud a statement with a couple of displays that went on for nearly 14 minutes, and therefore it is relevant. But then this is just somebody we're going to call your opponent, because I don't want to do it. You mentioned his name briefly, but let's be a little bit circumspect about it. I guess you do want me to plunge in, although I wanted actually to mention if there was something that you left out of your book and left out of your presentation that really mattered, maybe I could begin with that, Tom. Ironically, because you've had Jay Bhattacharya on the show, I guess had him discuss this, the basic background of what was going on in the early months of COVID really does begin with Jay Bhattacharya. And this is what you left out. I want to tell the story, if you'll bear with me.
Please.
The COVID lockdown started in the middle of March. The scares began like January, February of middle of March 2020, I should say. That's the year 2020. And in April, a month after April of 2020, Jay Bhattacharya initiated a zero prevalence study in a local county in California, Santa Clara County, I think it was. Anyway, it was a very well-designed study, and zero prevalence, that term, it almost sounds like zero. It simply tries to count up how many people have actually been infected, in this case, by the virus, and what has happened to them. How many have died? How many have been hospitalized? So it's an attempt to set up a numerator and a denominator. And the key thing to understand when you do such a study is that if they examine you, Tom, or examine me, and they find we have antibodies to the virus, they've known that we have the virus, if we have antibodies. And so in April of 2020, he gets his wife and his daughter involved with it, and a number of other people collaborating on it. He found that the prevalence of COVID was far greater than anybody had thought, that it actually had entered this country clearly later part of 2019. An enormous number of people had been infected. The vast majority of them didn't quite know it. Maybe they thought they had flu, maybe they had a minor cold, but they had the antibodies, and that was the evidence. And so he found that the death rate was 0.2%. 0.2%. And that 0.2% was contrary to the 3 and 4% and all those other crazy models that were being thrown out. And he found that out in April of 20, or maybe late April, once the data came in. And that data certainly became known by June of 2020. He also found what he calls the steep age gradient. He found right away, that it was overwhelmingly infecting the old and that it was barely touching the young. So all of that was known by Jay Bhattacharya and disseminated by June of 2020. And I think it's important to mention that because, and I think it's unfortunate that you didn't stress that the knowledge about the age gradient, especially, and of course, the very low, much lower incidence of deaths across the board in COVID was known that early on. And therefore, when I asked you the question, did the lockdowns have to happen? What are they claiming? Well, we did the best we could based on the knowledge that we had. The fact is that Bhattacharya was getting suppressed, he was getting abused, he was getting batted around for finding this out, which could have been the knowledge that we could have proceeded from. And the key knowledge being the age gradient, being that the established way of dealing with pandemics, which is to focus on the vulnerable, was supported overwhelmingly by his data. And the very low death rate from COVID was also being supported by his data. So the fear was not necessary and the lockdowns were not necessary that early on. And it was Bhattacharya and his colleagues who found this out. And I fault you in a way for not making this clear in your own presentation. I think it would have added perspective on it. Any comment on that before we proceed?
You're probably right. And when you asked me a question, I did mention seroprevalence, but I don't remember if I mentioned J.
But you didn't elaborate on the, and of course, you didn't have the data in front of you, because obviously since we spoke, I looked it up. And of course, when Jay was interviewed and by a number of people, he was asked, you know, this has to come from a Stanford professor. You know, the idea, the term is seroprevalence was funny. I kept stumbling on it. It sounded like seroprevalence. So this is like cookbook. This is like textbook approach to a disease is what he did. He didn't do anything greatly original. He just went out and found this out, and it was amazing the treatment he got. And of course, amazing that we knew all this so early on. But that's okay. I'm glad that you allowed me to make that point. And I guess I want to segue back into something else. What this meant then was that we had the clear target for focus protection. Although, I mean, we did have, of course, the complication about obesity, a point you've made, which is that some younger people are obese as well. But I think it is true that another point that you allowed me to make in the last interview, but is really that there were probably two things that made the lockdowns possible. One of them was Zoom. It probably is arguable that the laptop class would not have been able to survive the lockdowns if they didn't have Zoom, if they didn't have a way of operating, a way of communicating from their homes, with their pajamas on. And then, of course, the other part of it is the part that I've made, which is that they locked the economy down. They needed to raise nearly $6 trillion, and they had to get the Federal Reserve to print the money. And that, by the way, let's give a nod to our friend Saifedean Ammous. What Saif likes to do on his shows, as you probably know, is he always likes to say that this wouldn't have happened if we had Bitcoin. And in this case, he's right. If we had Bitcoin, this wouldn't have happened. The government would not have been able to borrow nearly $6 trillion. The hands would have been tied. They would have had to go the route that Jay Bhattacharya said they should go in, that was already well established: protect the vulnerable, do focused protection. And that's the point I made in my own debate, that in fact, the Federal Reserve printed so much money and caused the price inflation, which we discussed, is so important. But I wanted to mention now what your opponent said. Go over some of that. And what you did was, again, you were sensational. And maybe I should elaborate on why you were. Because, again, you had it all. You basically brought the audience through a whole range of displays in the space of a relatively short period of time. You turned over so many different rocks. You said, let's look at it from this standpoint, that standpoint, from the other standpoint. Yeah. And what you've managed to do is turn what you might call a laborious exercise into something that's rather fun. Because I guess when we're talking about what the powers that be were doing, and then we keep finding that everywhere we look, that they're always wrong, it gets increasingly amusing. I guess that's why you were able to hold your audience. And so you showed, the funniest thing in a way was that you showed lockdown states and then states that didn't lock down, and you asked the audience, "What? We don't see any difference." You weren't making any claims necessarily. You weren't pushing the argument too hard that the states didn't lock down did better. It just said that this didn't do anything. It began almost to become a funny joke. And then, of course, you also had timelines, which you said, well, where did Thanksgiving happen? And of course, after Thanksgiving, you expect a big surge in cases because everybody's infecting each other, and you showed the reverse. So you played all kinds of, you made line graphs fun, and you did it in a way, of course, with your usual sort of lively style. And I thought that was really superb. Maybe I should segue to the one long challenge that you did get from a young lady. You remember that, Tom?
Yeah, but before we do that, you started to say, oh, okay, so first you wanted to talk about what my opponent said, but then okay. You started with what I said.
Yeah.
How do we want to do that? I mean, maybe before we get to the Q&A, we should address a little something about his presentation?
Indeed. Yes.
So I have to admit, I was sitting with great anticipation as you read his statement, because I legitimately thought in 2024, with all this data readily available and all the speculative modeling having been more or less refuted, what could he possibly have to say on behalf of these interventions, you know, the lockdowns and the masks and the capacity restrictions and all that? What could he have to say? I mean, there's no data on his side. And the answer turned out to be not much. I listened. He started off by talking about members of his family, which I thought was ineffective. If he's making a 3-hour presentation, maybe you do that. But you have 17 and a half minutes that he didn't even use all of, and a big chunk of it is anecdotal from his family. I didn't think that was effective at all.
Well,
and then
yeah.
A lot of it was just talking, but without hard data. There was really only one chart he used from the COVID period.
Yes.
Only one.
Yes. Yeah. No. Well, because you're exactly. Well, that's your summary, because I rehearsed it. I read it out loud to my recorder twice to make sure I was getting the words out, to make sure that I was reading it with expression. And as a matter of fact, my son didn't get a chance to go. My son thought I was going to do a college-style debating the whole evening, and that I was going to pretend to be him even during the Q&A. And I said, I don't do that. I'll call. My grandson is a high school debater, and I think that's mostly sort of mind-riding experience. I said, no, I just read it out loud. And so what did I read out loud? I read out loud a reference to his family, but as you recall, he was talking about the influenza epidemic of
1918. Yeah.
And when I read over his statement after I received it initially, and when I noted that he had written me that he worked very hard on this statement, and I thought, you know, and then of course that only affirms one thing, which you understood as I pointed this out to you, that your initial statement is your best stuff. So you couldn't have missed out had the evening been a normal debate. You were just like, your initial statement was your best stuff. That, what else are you going to do? It's your best stuff. You might save a little bit for a rebuttal, but no, you start with your best stuff.
Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's the best way to serve the audience. It's the best way to do the debate. It's the best way to advance the argument, to join the argument. It's all consistent with what you should do. So this is his best stuff. And he's talking about the influenza epidemic of 1918 and how his grandmother died at the age of 65. And he's connecting it with the fact that she was infected with influenza when she was something like 2 years old in 1918. And as you say, that was really just an anecdote. There was nothing, if you wanted to talk about influenza epidemic of 1918 as directly analogous, then he really needed to explain a lot more than he actually did. He did throw up a chart in which I'm willing to believe that St. Louis versus Pittsburgh, that St. Louis shut the schools sooner than Pittsburgh did, that St. Louis did a kind of a lockdown that Pittsburgh didn't quite do, and Pittsburgh had worse outcomes than St. Louis. Okay. It's not, I mean, we would want to say a few things. Have you controlled for age? What was the age gradient? I don't even know, by the way, and I haven't bothered. What was the age gradient with respect to the influenza epidemic of 1918? Age gradient being that phrase I took about Acharya, which is that, does it disproportionately, is it equal proportional across ages about how the influenza epidemic affects people? I only know, because for me, famously, Randolph Bourne, the great left-wing critic of World War I, died in the flu epidemic, and a couple of other people did. I don't know much about it. So he explained virtually nothing about it. Maybe I'm beating a dead horse. I'm only saying that this is what you are up against, and there was really very little for you to respond to in that kind of analogy, because it really just wasn't enough there. I guess he would have pushed the point had he been there to debate you. I guess he would have elaborated on it in some way or another, but I doubt very much that it could have gotten very far, because it was really essentially a distraction. So that's what you were up against, his best stuff. And the only, as you said, the only chart that he did use that had to do with the COVID pandemic was also a dubious chart. He said it was red counties versus blue counties. He said it was counties, if you recall. And he had waves of deaths charted, red lines for the red counties and blue line for the blue counties. And the first problem, actually, as you mentioned a bit later, was that to use red versus blue being political references, the red states tend to be Republican, the blue states tend to be Democrat, that's not a marker that you used, you know.
And, right, because there were red states that had plenty of lockdown. And,
yeah.
I mean, red versus blue. The question is stringent versus lenient.
That's
the question. And then secondly, you can also, at some point, introduce into the question the ages of the places involved. Because if you're going to do red versus blue, well, some of the red states, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but I can think of quite a few red states where the average age seems to be considerably higher, where there is considerably more obesity among some demographics.
And
obesity is also a marker for mortality with this.
Yeah.
So that blue versus red, I think, just introduces a lot of vague or a lot of complications that just sticking to were they lenient or were they harsh gets to the bottom of.
Yes. Yeah. And that was the only joke. But by the way, I did speak to his research assistant and I asked him, well, you may not remember this, Tom, but in his first wave of deaths, the blue states were doing much worse. And I said, only later does he have the red states doing worse. But in the first big wave, the blue states, which is supposed to be the lockdown states, are doing considerably worse. And I asked his research assistant, what's he trying to show us here? It contradicts his point. And the research assistant was a bit baffled. He said, I guess, gave me a sort of vague response. Anyway, you were up against a lot of hot air. And I honestly think that if you and I were to brainstorm and try to think in terms of what, if we did want to play the college and high school debating game, which is argue the other side, I think you and I could do a better job, come up with something a little bit more imaginative, a little bit better than what he came up with. Although, I don't know, I guess maybe it is kind of a clever ploy to say red states versus blue states, if you believe in that, you know. And then a lot of references that war and pandemics are the big exceptions. He wanted you to know that he doesn't like government lockdowns either. And he doesn't like the whole idea, but Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, which I gather was not necessarily, he mentioned that, as you may recall.
Yeah, yeah.
We went, so you have to get a little bit totalitarian. There was a kind of a lot of rhetoric about this. And of course,
and not to mention, there was no expectation that I might have said, well, I wasn't in favor of that. Why? Just because you invoke some magic name, does that mean, well, I mean, if this particular political figure thought it was okay, then I guess we can't even debate it. This is a debate society. You know, this is a debate series.
Yes.
The whole point of it is to debate, not to just drop a name and say, well, this name says this is legitimate. We're here to debate.
Yes. Well, I'd have to say, well, I don't know. I guess as you and I would put it, even if he said, you know, like appeal to authority, well, if Abraham Lincoln did it, now come on, that's been the right thing to do. But you and I would say, look, even if you were to say Murray Rothbard said, even if you could say, oh, Ludwig von Mises said, you and I would say, even that doesn't wash. I'm sorry.
No, of course it doesn't. And you know, that's why Rothbard was happy to say Mises was wrong on this. And other people have been happy to say other people have been wrong. That's okay.
That's why, as I've told you, Tom, if I'm wrong, I want you to tell me. But anyway, okay. Anyway, so then, let's see. I guess that's pretty much it. You had very little to respond to. And so essentially, you were facing the audience. And now, I guess, what's funny is that we had a woman who was, I guess she was partly Swedish. I listened to it. She had lived in Shanghai for a while. I gave her a considerable amount of time to insult you, to rant at you about what she thought of your data. And there, it's funny, you weren't at your best, Tom. You're okay. But in responding to the biggest challenge that you've got all evening, I guess you were sort of rather, I thank you for your comments. You were rather pleased that you weren't cowing your audience, I guess. Anyway, but in particular, I think some of the points are kind of funny in a way. She said that she's been to Sweden and she's been to Italy. This is not why it was funny. And you can quote it. Do you remember what she said about Sweden versus Italy, Tom? I had to listen again.
Part of it was she's trying to argue that, quote, social distancing is just part of Swedish culture already. Right. Whereas in Italy, people want to hug you and shake your hand.
And touch each other's faces.
Yeah, so I have something to say to that. So I have one of the 817 million things that you get as a supporting listener of the Tom Woods Show membership in the Tom Woods Show Elite. And in there, we have a Swedish expat who says, I'm going to read this to you. I just put it on my screen. I just watched the event on Reason TV. I just have to say one thing. That half Swedish woman in the Q&A is full of you know what.
Yeah.
He says, social distancing is a cultural thing in Sweden? No, it isn't. Will someone seriously go to Stockholm and then come back to me and say with a straight face that social distancing is just the norm? No, that person is hallucinating. Go on the subway during rush hour traffic in April of 2020 and then say that again without laughing. Here's also where she's ignorant. Take a close look at where these COVID deaths occurred in Sweden. They occurred among the very ill and isolated nursing home patients with three or more comorbidities. This can be conceived as a scandal, understandably. The problem is that this just merely exposed how atrociously the elderly healthcare system is conducted. It brought to the surface a far deeper problem with the state-run nursing homes, which work more like hospices where seniors are neglected and left to die. If you account for this, then Sweden looks no different from its neighbors, even for 2020. For her claim about the excess deaths being worse in Sweden, he says, I think that's what she claimed.
Yeah, yeah.
He says she's just factually wrong, as I said. I can go to the Public Health Department agency's website and download these numbers in 30 minutes and project the elementary graphs in Google spreadsheet or Excel. Anyone can do this. I don't know what her motives were, but she was either ignorant or she was intentionally trying to gaslight people big time. Yeah, that's what people in my private group say.
Okay. Well, no, that's a good call. Yeah, no, as a matter of fact, I'm being hard on you. You're okay in responding to her. You did not make the point about the excess deaths. Of course, you could have given her more attention and said that that this fetish about limiting Sweden to comparisons only with Denmark and Norway is just a convenience and really a little bit superficial. The idea that you can't bring in Germany or England, you know, is a little bit silly. But indeed, I looked it up in your book, and you had the excess deaths listed in your book. And indeed, Sweden's excess deaths over the entire period were slightly lower than Norway's and Denmark's. They were the lowest of all.
Yeah.
And I guess you did make that point. It's just that I think you should have taken like twice as much time to respond to questions.
Yeah, I guess part of it was, I don't know, sometimes if I'm confronted like that, I'm not tough and I'm too easy on people. And obviously I have all the answers in the sense that I know what the correct response to her is on her various objections. But okay, I'll reveal something about myself, okay?
Okay. This is good.
In the old days, when I was in graduate school, let's say, and then maybe 10 years afterward, I become a better debater after a few drinks. Now, this does not proceed infinitely upward, because eventually, like all people, you hit a point where you suddenly become a very, very poor debater.
Order what the vodka, Tommy, that only told me.
Well, these days, my tolerance level's so low because I don't drink all that much. The reason for that, I'm convinced, is that normal. I mean, I know how this sounds. I know it sounds like I must be some arrogant jerk, but I'm not. It's that I genuinely don't like to humiliate people. You know, I try to make my points. Now, in the printed word, yeah, all bets are off. But if I'm face to face with somebody, I genuinely don't want to make them look ridiculous. But after a few drinks, the inhibitions are lowered. And then suddenly I just want to win. It doesn't matter what the collateral damage is. I want to win. And I don't have that burning desire to win in my normal, you know, again, if I were sitting down writing this out, yeah, she would have no limbs remaining. But in person, I don't have that same, I don't know, I don't have it.
That's interesting. I actually reflect then that the absence of your opponent when you got up to speak, of course, I guess it was pretty much a prepared text. I guess it would have come out the same way, but probably helped a little bit that he wasn't there. He was absent, and so to speak, there was nobody up there for you to humiliate. It might even have enhanced your performance.
Well, let's say something just really quickly, then we'll try to start wrapping up. Let's say something about, in the question period, what I had planned, and we did do it, but obviously not with the same effect, was in the question period, the rules at the Soho Forum are that the debaters may ask each other a question at any time.
Yeah.
And also they take questions from the audience. So I had a question prepared for my opponent, and it was like a video daily double kind of question because it involved a slide I had not included in my presentation. And it's the slide, and I very much regret that I did not credit her at the time, but every other time I've used this slide, I have credited Catherine Hewig. But I showed her slide from Ohio in 2020, and it's like COVID patients over time, but the x-axis is unlabeled, so you don't know where the different months are, or you just know this is some section of 2020, that's all you know. And she proposed that the state legislators she was speaking to, who were responsible for the various policies implemented, the curfews, the capacity restrictions, the masks, the lockdowns, all that, ought to be able to identify certain markers on that graph. They ought to be able to identify when the mask mandate was put into effect, or the curfew was put into effect, or the George Floyd protests occurred, or Thanksgiving occurred. So I was going to sit there and list 8 or 10 things and ask if my opponent could identify at least a few of them on the graph.
Yeah.
And I said at the event, I said, now, obviously my opponent is not present, but I pointed out that I actually agonized over this because this would humiliate him because there is no way for him to know these allegedly essential things. That's the word in the debate resolution, that these measures were essential. He's arguing that they're essential, and yet he can't pick out one major marker on that graph. And he darn well better be able to if he's going to argue that they were essential. And he wouldn't have been able to. And I said to the audience that I agonized over this because, of course, I want to win the debate, but I don't want to make him look ridiculous. So the way I was going to phrase it, very much trying to be as charitable as possible, was to say, look, this is not a strike at my opponent. I couldn't do this either. Nobody can do this. Now, the point of it is that nobody can do this. And the question that should arise from this is, shouldn't we be able to, if the narrative that was fed to us about the numbers going down when you behave and they go up when you're a dumb, stupid head who hates science, if that's true, these things should be detectable on this graph and they're not.
Yeah. And I guess you were saying, I was trying to push that point. You remember we had an email exchange about that, and I tried to suggest to you that you say, look, I couldn't pass this test either, and all the rest of it. I could see that you were electing to humiliate.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, and I'm looking forward to seeing you very soon at my Practical Liberty Unconference in June 2024, this very year, just a couple months from now. Practical Liberty, because we're not going to be doing any abstract libertarian theorizing. We're not going to be debating how we would apply Lockean homesteading theory to outer space or what libertarians should think about consensual cannibalism. No, none of that stuff. Instead, it's going to be all practical things. We're going to be talking about practical things that you need to know in order to survive under a hostile regime, which is indeed what we live under. And it's an unconference because, you know, you go to a conference, you sit through a whole lot of talks. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, you're really only interested in two or three of them. You got to just sit through the whole thing. There isn't going to be any sitting through anything. On the Saturday of the conference, we're all going to talk to each other. How about that for a novel idea? We're going to break into separate rooms and people will lead discussions on all kinds of topics, 25 minutes at a time. You can speak on anything you want or you can just listen. So we'll have a business room where people can discuss or ask questions about or get feedback on any business topic. We'll have a room on personal development so people can talk about how they lost 50 pounds or the three tactics they used to overcome procrastination or how they became 20% more productive. We'll have another room talking about parallel institutions like monetary institutions like Bitcoin or educational institutions like homeschooling, whatever else you can think of. And if you have better ideas than these, we'll consider those too. Everybody's going to leave with exciting new ideas and new friends and connections. Not to mention, we will conclude our event with a brand new show from the outstanding world-class magician Doc Dixon, who is 100% one of us and top-notch. He fooled Penn and Teller on their Fool Us television show. We'll also be joined by our old friend Jeff Deist. It's going to be a fantastic time. Check it out at tomwoods.com/unconference. And you can bring a plus one for free. That's tomwoods.com/unconference.
I just want to return to that lady who was partly from Sweden. Interesting about the Swedish and whether they touch each other or not. But you sort of said, but didn't, I think, say strongly enough that the whole point is that I'm looking under 90 rocks. The whole point is that, let's even say you're right, the Swedish don't touch each other. The Italians do. We've got to make up an excuse for 90 charts, 300 charts, 900 charts. As I keep saying, when we look at economic data, we're the blind man roping the elephant. The thing is, what I'm doing is I'm beating a dead horse. And then I even liked your point when you initially said that you're lining up the states that were loose versus the states that were tight. Look at the similarities. I could just as well sit down and rest my case now. I remember you said that.
Yeah. As far as I can see, this wins the debate for me, but I'm a sport. I have some more time, so I'll show you some more things.
The point is that you're being almost obsessive to a fault, except that putting it in quiz form or actually looking on different rocks and playing different games with the charts is actually quite amusing. It's only that you would have pointed out to her that even if you write about the Swedes versus the Italians, show me 10 charts that look differently. She felt that ultimately, I guess this is a problem, and I think she was being sincere. She felt that ultimately we will never know and in what the answer is. And to that, of course, you would say the reason why you were angry. Remember, she objected to the fact that you betrayed some anger. You know,
yeah.
If we'll never know what the answer is, then let's concede that that's in a way what I'm saying. But what else am I saying? What we do know is all the harms that these totalitarian measures did. That's what we do know. And you might have been, with especially the guy's grandmother who died at the age of 65, many decades later because of the flu epidemic, you can even say, look, many decades from now, maybe we'll find something out that we just never knew about this, about long COVID or whatever. We can only run our world based upon what we can know. The lockdowns did incredible harm, and the burden of proof was on those who proposed.
Yeah, well, I gave the example. I said this whole thing of, well, maybe somehow we could find some data that does it. She wanted to know, like, what were the sources of all my data and how was it gathered? Well, the sources are all listed on the slides and they're all mainstream sources. But is she actually going to propose that all the problem is that every single gathering of data was faulty except the one that my opponent showed? I mean, is that? And so I said, well, this kind of reminds me of somebody who claims he can speak 25 languages.
Yes.
Then you ask him, oh, that's really very impressive. Can you speak some for me now? Nope. And I never will. Just take my word for it that I speak 25 languages. I don't think I believe you. You know, you got to actually show me that you do it. You know, so show me some of this evidence that allegedly exists before I depurified it or something. Go gather it for me. Let's see it.
As I keep belaboring, at least to pointing out to you, that there is that great multivariate analysis in the sky that can figure out all 20 variables that might affect COVID outcomes, not just the easy ones like obesity and age. But I don't think we can ever do that. We can only really do what you've done, which is turn over every rock. And indeed, you might even say, look, all my sources are reputable. But if we really bore down, are two or three of them a little off? Is this perfection? Probably not. That's the reason why I keep beating this dead horse. That's the reason why I keep belaboring the point. I look under every rock possible, and I find the same thing. No matter where you look, this is what I find. So that, and indeed, as you said, you weren't drunk enough. To give her a hard time, you thanked her, and she said that she didn't like your line drives. No, you just doing line drives like this guy. And I don't know what she wanted in the end, and it is funny, but that Swedish point, the Swedes versus the Italians, and how much they touch each other. It almost just a silly rabbit hole to go down, because as I said, look, if you want to make, but actually, I would have thought that if you want to go Scandinavian on us, I would imagine that if it's true of the Swedes, it's true of the Danes and the Norwegians, because they're all Scandinavian. They don't touch each other, and yet the excess deaths in Denmark and Norway were even worse. So let's see. I don't know if you want me to include, but my favorite, my most memorable quote from your book actually was something you published earlier, and then you put it in your book, and it's from, I think it was a woman who wrote, this quote, "I relinquish any claims on the lives of the young. As an oldster who is presumed to be peculiarly susceptible to the ravages of COVID-19, I will not ask anyone to sacrifice days, weeks, or months of their time, love, life, and livelihood on my behalf. It is grotesque for the old to ask the young to sacrifice for them. Go live your lives. Enjoy the beautiful spring weather. I have no claim on you for my welfare. Who among my fellow oldsters will release any claims on the lives of young people?" And I was very moved by that. You know, she's not an elegant writer, but there's something very blunt and very beautiful about that statement. You published it early on, and then you did run it in your book. And certainly it spoke for me as an oldster, that this in a way was, that really was this generational fight then that we oldsters were trying to impose on the young, this unfair claim on their precious time and their precious lives. And I thought that was especially touching. I could go into some other issues, Tom, but I think you probably want me to shut up and maybe just take a moment to talk about what I planned for the Soul Forum. You give me that?
Yeah, let's just, the next one, boy, do I wish I, unfortunately, I'm going to be out of the country. I would have flown back to New York for this one. The one you have coming up
on the 20th,
in May really going to be something to see. So who are the two debaters?
Well, it's Alan Dershowitz. It's Alan Dershowitz versus Glenn Greenwald.
And no, so even before knowing what the topic is, that alone you should want to go see.
Well, yeah, and we were very eager to get Dershowitz. He's 85 years old. One of the things I haven't agreed with Alan Dershowitz about a lot of things, to say the least. And of course, I would be the usual, totally fair-minded debater. Nobody's ever accused me of favoring one side or the other when I moderated a debate. But even though I disagree with Dershowitz about a number of things, the fact that he's 85 years old and that he's still very cognitively alive is something that I rather admire, pushing 80 myself. So I think that's rather good that he's that old, but he's plenty feisty. And I don't have the exact wording, but it's somewhere here. But he wants the U.S. to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. And that's what he chose. We were really eager to get him. And Glenn Greenwald actually likes debating. When you talked about how this is, you got to get a little drunk to enjoy it, I'm a little bit ambivalent. For me, it's always a stressful situation, but I feel that if I'm good at it, and of course I run the debate society, I have an obligation to do it, but I'm not quite, I was stunned by Dave Smith talking about how much he loves it.
It's almost, I find it very stressful too.
Humiliating people. For you, but he loves it. And Glenn Greenwald, it's easy enough to see if you just listen to his show that he would be skilled as a debater. Actually, when he was appearing on some of that soundbite TV where debating certain people and getting in his remarks, he's incredibly fast on his feet. He's quite gifted. And so he did want to come, but Dershowitz at the last minute chose this Iranian thing. And of course, obviously, Iran has been in the news. That's going to be on the 20th. Ironically and coincidentally, although not really so, it's going to be at Symphony Space on 95th Street and Broadway, which is, I think, another debate that you missed. That's where we held the debate between Scott Horton and William Kristol. And another foreign policy debate. And why am I laughing? Whenever I think about that debate, Scott Horton, I think, overdid it. It was fair in a way to accuse William Kristol of being a war criminal, which is practically what he did. But he followed when Bill had to take a plane, and he followed Kristol up the aisle, and he said, "Let's get together. Let's keep in touch." And Kristol turned around to him and said, "I don't want to have anything to do with you ever again." And the funny part of it is that I said to Scott, "What is wrong with you? What else do you expect the guy to do? You talk about humiliating somebody. You humiliated his argument, and then you practically called him a war criminal. And you think he wants to be friends still? You know, that's Scott. There's something a little bit. Scott is one of our, as I've mentioned, our only authentic genius. I'm talking about Scott Horton. I should be talking about in our debates. We've got two very smart people, Greenwald versus Dershowitz, coming up on the 20th. And we actually are going to do an after party. That's 700 seats, way more. We've already sold 400 tickets to that debate, and we barely even advertised it. And so it's good. Those of you who are listening, go into thesoulforum.org, and you'll find the tickets are on sale. We will be posting our after party in about a week. We're not going to have an after party at a place called Carmine's, four blocks away, and we expect a lot of people to come, but my assistant wants to give out some VIP tickets before we start selling tickets to the after party. 700 people are going to come to the debate, and we'll only have room for about 125 to come to the after party, but at least we do, but Dershowitz and Karma and Glenn Greenwald will both come to the after party. And in fact, the very next night, Nick Gillespie is going to do an interview with Glenn Greenwald. And you know what's interesting about Glenn Greenwald? An interesting moment is when he was on the Scott Horton show. And Scott asked him, told him, "You don't do a whole lot about economics. I gather you're left-leaning." And interestingly, he said very honestly, "I don't, because I do feel that I'm on shaky ground. I do have left-leaning tendencies," he said, "but I don't feel that I ultimately know enough about economics to comment on, except Glenn."
Gene, if only 99% of mankind could be as humble as Glenn Greenwald on this issue.
No. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, it was interesting to me that Scott got that admission out of him, and indeed, that did show a lot of humility. I'm a huge fan of Glenn Greenwald's most of the time, because most of the time he makes an awful lot of sense about political issues and civil rights, and all of that good stuff. And of course, I admire his heroism for his involvement with Edward Snowden. So that's going to be a big debate. And in June, I'm taking the show on the road to Porkfest, and I'm close to negotiating another debate with David Friedman about what the Austrian School versus the Chicago School. And here I will out our friend Bob Murphy. 10 years ago, Bob Murphy had a debate with David about Austrian School versus Chicago School. And I think Bob probably could do better today in that debate. I saw that debate not long ago, and I thought that it would be interesting to have a rematch with David. David and I had a debate the year before. David doesn't believe in the non-aggression principle. That debate, by the way, is available on our website, you might be interested to see me versus David. David believes that the non-aggression principle is incoherent and irrelevant. And I argued that with him, and I won according to hostage style debating. I was told that our debate went over very well with the audience. It was a big draw. And so I think it would be a nice favor to the Parkfest people if we did another debate up there. And I'm going to be, that's in June. And in July, we are returning to the COVID issue. I'm getting Matt Ridley, the best-selling author, Matt Ridley, to defend the resolution that the SARS-CoV probably originated from the Wuhan lab. It's likely that it originated from the Wuhan lab. And in that particular case, I had a very difficult time getting an opponent. He's going to be taking on a scientifically trained epidemiologist. Now, he's a journalist, but he will be punching above his weight, taking on someone who I initially offered him a good sum of money, and then I had to practically triple it to get this gentleman to come to debate Matt. So that's part of what goes on, where I get a lot of people who are reluctant to debate. But if I give them a good payday, then they'll debate. And as Tom Woods has just announced, if I give them a good payday, $100,000.
Yeah, just
back and
start debate. Start a GoFundMe, you know.
And this time I'll bring the vodka for Tom to loosen up. And we will look forward to that at some point. And then in addition, as I mentioned, I'm going to be doing debates about who to vote for. And it looks as though I have Art Laffer lined up of the Laffer curve to defend voting for Trump. And David Stockman is very eager to come to defend voting for RFK Jr. And I'm going to have them oppose the Libertarian candidates on those issues. I'm going to have the VP candidate oppose David on RFK Jr. and the presidential candidate oppose Laffer on voting for Trump. I probably won't get anybody to defend voting for Biden. But I don't know. If any of you out there think I should get someone to defend voting for Biden, then maybe we'll get Tom Woods to oppose that for $100,000.
Well, we'll check that. We'll give that some thought.
I guess I'll shut up, Tom. I had some other things to say, but I guess I've exhausted my time. And I appreciate you having me on once again. And I want to conclude by saying congratulations on a superb showing. Again, I think that you really haven't experienced, you've experienced Tom Woods in many guises, but this is a special experience to hear Tom Woods going on for about 20 minutes, 22 minutes about what happened with respect to the lockdowns. It was a superb performance, and I think that he was well-oiled, well-prepared, and I think my debate format brought out the best in Tom.
Thank you very much, Gene, for those kind words. Everybody, the website for the Soho Forum, thesohoforum.org. Check out my particular event. We've got the video. You can also listen on their podcast. We have the video linked in the description of the video and also at tomwoods.com/2485. So thank you, Gene, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.